You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season on Working, we took a trip to Baltimore to chat with some of its residents about the various ways they make their livings there. We're hoping to learn a little about how Baltimore shapes their work and about how they're shaping Baltimore by working. For our second episode, we visited with Carita Collins, who runs the Neighborhood Fiber Company, a yarn dyeing business that operates out of a 19th century firehouse in Baltimore. They supply knitters with an astonishing array of hand-dyed yarns, all of them named after neighborhoods in Baltimore and other cities. Collins shared some of her backstory with us, telling us how she ended up founding the company in the first place, gave us a tour of the space, talking us through the dyeing process along the way, and, of course, she also discussed her business's relationship to Baltimore itself, sharing some of the ways that they've tried to respond to local events. As someone who loves fine wools, loves a good sweater, I was delighted to learn some of the process that actually goes into shaping those fundamental materials. It's both more complicated and more compelling than I would have imagined. Then, in a Slate Plus Extra, Collins gets into some of her own knitting projects and explains what makes someone knit-worthy. If you're a member, enjoy bonus segments and interview transcripts from Working, plus other great podcast exclusives. Start your 2-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus. What is your name and what do you do?
My name is Carita Collins, and I am the owner slash president of the Neighborhood Fiber Company.
So we are in the space of the Neighborhood Fiber Company today. Can you tell us a little bit about where we are and what you do here?
Well, we are in a historic firehouse.
It's very cool.
That was built in 1865, I think, and has been converted into a hand-dyed yarn studio. You probably want to ignore that. That's going to be the UPS or mail. Just let this happen. Okay, so we are in an old firehouse that has been converted into a hand-dyed yarn studio.
And what do you do in this hand-dyed yarn studio?
Well, we dye yarn, mostly for knitting and crochet, but, you know, hand knitters, not for mass production, knitting machine kind of stuff. It's small batch, kind of, it has been referred to as artisan.
Mm-hmm. Is that a dirty word?
No, it just sounds a lot more, to me it sounds a lot more pretentious and a lot less physically intensive. Like, mm-hmm. What we do is physical labor. Yeah. At some point I shifted from being an individual artist to being a manufacturer of a product. So
let's take a step back. How did you get into yarn dyeing in the first place?
My best friend from high school taught me how to knit after we both graduated from college. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she came over to my house and we sat on the couch and it was sort of the total normal, let me show you how to do this cool thing I learned. And for me, it just felt like coming home. Like, how have my hands not been doing this my entire life? This is amazing. Mm. And I got kind of obsessed. Mm-hmm. And I started knitting all the time. I was about to start grad school, so I was knitting through all of my grad school classes.
So how did you get from that time where you're just knitting to a time where you were dyeing yarn?
Yeah, I got a job after grad school with a yarn store, and I was the manager of a yarn store in DC. My mom was super proud and totally excited about me using all of my degrees for that. So, and also it was awesome for paying my student loans.
I'm sure.
But while I was there, I had the decision that I wanted to open a yarn business. I wasn't sure what kind of yarn business, but I knew I couldn't afford to open a yarn store in D.C. Mm. But my mom was like, I'll lend you $1,000 if you write a business plan for you to start this yarn dyeing business that you want to start. And I don't think anyone took me seriously. Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't approach it seriously. I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to write the narrative of a business plan and skip all of the financial worksheets. Mm-hmm. I was in a basement apartment, and it was just me kind of experimenting and figuring things out. I'm completely self-taught.
So why yarn dyeing in the first place?
I figured I had a pretty good sense of color, and that was pretty much it. I was like, I can do this. Why not yarn dyeing? Also, I wanted certain colors, and they weren't there. So, you know, I am already a maker, so why wouldn't I just make the colors happen?
Do you remember what your first color that you made was?
Yes, the first color I made was a hand-painted color that we no longer make. It had much more defined chunks of color. It was named after LaDroit Park, which is where I was living at the time. And it was purple and green with some like dark green browns in it. But it was mostly my attempt to combine purple and green because I was only just then beginning to appreciate green through its interplay with purple.
At that point, were you using the technique that you've come to use in your shop?
Generally speaking, yes. I was doing the same things. I started it with the idea that I needed to make colors that were, to a certain extent, repeatable because people want to be able to buy enough for a whole sweater. But also, we've refined the process a lot and gotten a lot more consistent. Some things have had to change because it's not me dyeing anymore. For a while, it was not just me dyeing, and now I don't really dye yarn at all. But we have three different people who are dyeing yarn, so it needs to be consistent across all three employees. So we have like really intricate formulas all the way down to like adding a half teaspoon of liquid to a giant pot of water.
Wow. But before we get to that, though, how did you go from running this small thing that was trending toward a business to actually having this beautiful shop that we're in today?
The main catalyst was that I realized that I couldn't afford to live in DC anymore. I had quit my job sort of spontaneously, again, without really running all the numbers, because who wants to do numbers? That's so boring. But, you know, just based on, I have a sense that this is going to work out. And as it happens, after that, I broke up with my long-term girlfriend and realized that, no, it really is not going to work out. I don't have any money. My car got repossessed. I ended up moving to Columbus, Ohio, where I had a friend, because it is super cheap to live in Columbus, Ohio compared to Washington, D.C. And my friend told me I could dye yarn in the basement of her yarn shop. So, you know, thus began my series of yarn dungeons, like serious old school basement yarn dyeing studios.
You're working with a lot of chemicals, as I understand it. How was that in
a
basement?
Oh, God, it was, I wore a mask. I still, like, everyone still wears a mask when we're working. But, yeah, no, I was not working in properly ventilated spaces. I was just sort of chancing it, just supreme confidence. You know, it takes a certain amount of, I think, ego to open a business and think, yeah, what I'm making is specific and special enough that people should pay me money for it. And also, you know, I was younger, so I was in my 20s. I figured I'll be fine. I don't have health insurance or anything, but everything's gonna be fine.
Was it?
No, it was terrible, but it got better. I, you know, kind of started from scratch in a lot of ways. I busted my ass. I worked hard and I put out as much product as I could, which was not a lot because I couldn't afford to buy a lot of product. And
I assume the raw yarn that comes in is already pretty expensive.
Yeah. When you, I mean, it's priced per pound, and the price break you get comes with the more you buy. So for someone like me at that time, the mill that we're working with now, I couldn't afford to work with them because their minimum order is 600 pounds.
Wow. Of any given...
Of any given thing that you order, you have to get 600 pounds of it.
So we're talking 600 pounds of this particular cashmere merino blend
right,
or whatever.
And 600 pounds of yarn is a full pallet. Like, picture a pallet and picture it stacked about as high as, you know, your height.
That's a lot of yarn.
Yes. I didn't have anywhere to put it. I definitely couldn't pay for it. So
how much does that cost?
Depending on what it is, anywhere, like around $13,000.
Wow.
It's about what we are paying for that amount of yarn, including shipping, and there's other shenanigans to pay for.
Taxes and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Import.
So at that point, when you're in Columbus in a basement, still kind of hardscrabble, it sounds like.
Definitely.
But at some point, you find your way to Baltimore.
Well, my grandmother got sick, and this was at the point where things had kind of just started to shift for me in Columbus. I wasn't making a lot of money, but I was making enough money, and I was starting to kind of crawl my way out of this hole. But my grandmother got sick. She was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. It was a terminal diagnosis from the beginning.
Yeah.
So, again, I am not risk averse, and I just jump into things. So I was like, I'll just move in and take care of her, obviously, because then she can stay in her house, which is what she wants. So I packed up everything and moved to my grandmother's house in Baltimore County, put my dye set up in her basement.
Another dungeon.
Another yarn dungeon. I've pretty much had figured out that I can make any space work as long as there's plumbing.
Because you need water, heat.
I bring my own little stoves.
Got your own little stoves. And that's it?
That's it.
Drying racks, I assume?
I just set those up outside.
Nice.
There was a clothesline, so.
So did you start to build a business clientele here in Baltimore?
I did, a little bit. I was kind of doing the bare minimum of dyeing because it was only happening after she went to bed, which was honestly like 8 o'clock, because she was sick. So, you know, for those few months, my whole life was really focused on taking care of her. And then after she died, I was pretty miserable. And, you know, also I was living in her house by myself, which was kind of creepy, and also wasn't helping my sort of mental health and social life because all of my neighbors were over 70. And I needed to get out of that house. So I was looking for places to live. I didn't actually think I could afford to stay in Baltimore. I was looking at going back to Columbus because I knew I could actually afford to live there. But I found this artist apartment building that I thought was a Craigslist scam, but I still called them and went there, and it turned out to be a real thing, which was a whole new building of apartments that were designed for low-income artists or low to moderate income artists. And I jumped at the chance. Barely passed the credit check, got in there, and suddenly I had a studio apartment that was full of light and neighbors who were also artists closer to my own age, and had a sink in the dining room. So the dining room became the dye kitchen, and I set up and I got to work. And that really was a big turning point for me.
When did you open this shop? How did that come about?
My apartment was my workspace for a while. Then I moved into a different studio space that was only a studio space. It was in a storefront, but we weren't open because it was 700 square feet. And suddenly I found myself with all of that piled to the ceiling with yarn. And it still wasn't properly ventilated, so it was hot as balls. Like, the UPS guy would come in the summer from outside, like from hauling boxes around in 95 degree heat in Baltimore, and would walk into our studio and say, I got to get out of here. It's too hot. That UPS guy is actually my husband now.
Nice.
But we just outgrew it. We needed something bigger. And we found this firehouse. It had been vacant for years. It had been a kind of halfway house, rehab, homeless shelter situation before that. It was actually functional as a firehouse until, I want to say, the 90s, maybe. But it was a mess. Like, it was a mess. There were occasionally homeless people sleeping in the basement. It was just a mess. And
you cleaned it up?
The landlord cleaned it up. The city was very anxious to have it occupied because it's a really visible location for this neighborhood. So the city sold the property to my landlord, and he and I negotiated a lease, and that included all of the build out for this space. And then suddenly I had a storefront. Like, suddenly I have a yarn store instead of just a yarn dyeing company.
But it's also a functional studio, just looking around.
It is. It is a functional production space. And that was always intended to be the main focus of this space. Mm-hmm. And the retail side of things was incidental. It was what we did because people expect us to have a retail space in this building. Mm-hmm. It was what we did because we needed some place to put the yarn anyway. So why not, you know, display it?
So how many people work here now or work with you?
Well, so first of all, I am now actually a paid employee, which is awesome. And I have two other salaried employees, both of whom are here today. And then we have a couple of students who work here, and one intern right now.
Nice.
After this brief break, Carita Collins gives us a tour of the Neighborhood Fiber Company and describes the yarn dyeing process.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So here's the thing. I know nothing about actually dyeing yarn, but I'm looking around this space that we're in, and there is just this astonishing array of variegated hues, sometimes even in a single thread, a single fiber. There's all of these colors. What do you have to do to actually dye yarn?
We kettle dye, which means that we dye our yarn in big pots. Mm-hmm. And we dye protein fibers, so wool, silk, alpaca, cashmere, things made of animals, mostly.
As opposed to synthetic fibers?
As opposed to synthetics, or as opposed to cotton.
Okay.
Plant fibers, cellulose fibers. The dye that we use is specifically made for silk and wool fibers. It's called acid dyeing. Which sounds super scary, but the acid we use is citric acid. So basically a combination of dye, heat, acid is what makes the color stick to the yarn.
Okay. Where are the dyes coming from? What are you making them yourself?
No. We order our dyes from a commercial dye manufacturer in New York City. Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason that you focus on protein fibers, is that the term you used?
Yes. Well, there are two reasons. One, acid dyeing is easier than dyeing cotton.
And it doesn't work on cellulose fibers and such as well? Is that the idea?
Right. It doesn't work on the cellulose fibers. And also, I like wool. Mm-hmm. I like the way wool feels. Mm-hmm. I like cashmere. I like silk. I like things that have the properties of wool. Wool is amazing, and it gets a bad rap. It's not scratchy all the time. So
some of it can be.
Some of it's scratchy. It depends on the breeds. When you get really into nerdy knitting, you start to pay attention to sheep breeds and, you know, talk about the, you know, the micron count and the staple length of a merino sheep versus a blue-faced Leicester versus a Targhee versus a bunch of other different really specific sheep breeds.
Let's get really nerdy though. Like, are you sourcing from particular countries? Where's the actual fiber that you dye coming from?
Most of what we do is merino. All of our merino comes from a mill in Canada. Mm-hmm. They're milling the yarn. That's not where the fiber comes from.
Merino are alpine sheep, I think, right?
Merino are New Zealand sheep.
Right.
New Zealand, Australia.
But they live on mountains, right?
Yes. They're in hillsides, kind of. They need a lot of green, but they're not like alpaca, which are serious mountain creatures.
And also not sheep, right?
Also not sheep, correct.
Yeah.
Different. They are from the camelid family. So merino sheep live in New Zealand and Australia, and that's where most of our wool comes from, but it comes by way of Canada.
So you're mostly working with this Canadian mill, which is
for the most part.
What are the elements of the process that they do? What does the raw material look like when it comes into your shop, into your hands?
Into our hands, we get boxes of yarn that's on cones. So imagine like a big thing of butcher's twine wrapped around a cone. That's what we get.
But thicker and softer usually, I'm assuming?
Softer, thicker, sometimes thinner. Mm-hmm. Depends on what kind of fiber it is or what it's used for. We have 15 different kinds of yarn that we dye, so it just depends.
So can you just show us some of the areas of your workspace in the store here?
Sure. So this is our yarn winding area. It allows us to take the yarn from cones, which are not saleable or dyeable, to skeins, which is how we package the yarn individually. So what we have here is a big red piece of machinery that has, I don't really know how to describe it. It's got
it's like
kind
a big
of
big red frame. It's like, it looks like these are, can I move this thing? Is it like sort
mm-hmm.
of?
It moves.
Like wheel, it's almost like a drying rack, but on a wheel?
Yeah, and what it does is.
Or a windmill almost?
It does. It's kind of like in an X configuration with like two X's that are like 3 feet apart, and they've got a bar through the center of them, and the top of the X's have wooden pieces.
And you wind the raw yarn around that to.
Yes, you put the yarn around the wooden pieces, and then you set the rotation counter so that each skein is the same length. And then you hit the green button for go, and the red button for stop. But when we are actually winding yarn, it automatically stops.
Once you've wound them off, what's the next step? What do you all do with them?
Well, you make sure that you have put dye ties on them, because...
What's a dye tie?
A dye tie is a piece of cotton that is looped through the yarn in strategic places to keep it from becoming a horrible tangled mess.
Like my headphones in my pocket?
Yes. Imagine if you had some sort of way to keep those organized.
I would probably be very happy.
Mm-hmm.
So what function does that serve besides preventing it from dying? How does that help you then also dip it into the
It is 100%. It is 100% about keeping the skeins from getting tangled, and also making it easy for our customers to wind it off into a ball, because you can't actually knit from the skein.
Okay.
Kristen has just brought over a cone, an undyed skein bundle, and a fully dyed skein. So we get it on the cone, which is right here. This is a bundle. We dye multiple skeins at a time, and when they come off the winder, we bundle them into the correct increments.
Okay.
So this particular yarn, we dye five at a time. So this is a bundle of five. These are the dye ties that I mentioned.
They look a lot like the yarn itself.
Yes, but
they're
cotton.
In this state, the yarn is
in this state, the yarn
white,
is white.
Almost ivory colored.
Yeah, the dye ties are also white. But once they go through the process of being dyed, we end up with a skein that looks like this. So this is...
So now we've got this vibrant blue.
Yes, and with white ties.
Because they don't hold the dye that you are dipping it into?
Exactly. It makes it easier for us when we're rinsing, and for the customers when they go to wind it into a ball.
Should we look at the dyes and then maybe the stove?
Sure. So after the yarn is wound, we've got it in bundles and we can soak it. So we have this whole triple sink setup, and one of the sinks we use for soaking the yarn. It helps the fibers open up and also helps to remove any like chemical gunk that may be on there that would prevent the dye from adhering to the yarn. Mm. And the sink is conveniently right next to all of the dyes. Here are our dye stock solutions.
They're in a big range of jugs, it looks like.
Yeah,
we've all got all the same size, labeled with the colors.
A bunch of gallon jugs with a bunch of different color dyes in them, and they're all labeled. And Astrid left them really neat, so they're all facing with their labels out to minimize the likelihood that we will grab the wrong thing, which sometimes creates really cool new colors, and other times just makes a mess.
And then there are powders down below?
There are dye powders down here, and measuring cups up here, and we use the measuring cups to mix the dye stock solutions from the powder. It's 1 teaspoon of powder to 1 cup of water. So, you know, for a gallon, that's 16 scoops, 16 teaspoons, and a gallon of water.
And then you pour those into these huge pots that are on this enormous stove of yours?
Yes, we have this giant stove with 10 burners, and I used to tell people that we spent a lot of time waiting for water to boil because the water has to get hot before you can put the yarn in the pot. Now that we have this super heavy-duty industrial stove, it happens a lot faster.
Real heavy-duty.
It puts out 550,000 BTUs of heat. It is literally the maximum amount of stove that we could have in this space.
Like legally?
Yes. And well, in terms of how much gas is coming into the building, we're using all of it. These are 24 quart pots, stock pots, and we put the dye in there along with a bunch of water and citric acid, which is the acid that we use to make the dye stick to the fiber.
It helps it penetrate the fiber?
Mm-hmm. It's what makes it wash fast. It's what makes it stay. So we keep the citric acid in like an IKEA bin, and we scoop it out as we need it. We fill the pots with this pot filler that I had put in because I was trying to
minimize. Pot filler, it looks like a hose.
It is. It's like a really long hose with a spigot. It's designed to fill pots on a stove. The water actually comes out really slowly because it's designed for restaurants and they're not super interested in very quickly filling giant.
Do you have to filter the water here?
No. We just sort of go with it. Okay. So whatever weird, you know, variations we get because of Baltimore City water, that's part of the product.
It's neighborhood yarn, neighborhood fiber.
Exactly. It is exactly what you get from this neighborhood.
And then after they come off the stove, it looks like the pots go sit over here to
yes,
cool?
Yes, they rest is what we call it. So we just grab the pot holders, carefully move the really hot, really heavy
onto these metal tables.
Yeah, these low equipment stands is what I think they were called when I bought them. I just wanted something that didn't involve lifting it up to minimize the strain on my back. So
reasonable. They look heavy.
They are very heavy, and they are very hot. So you have to be very careful when you handle them.
Do they ever spill?
I mean, yeah, but we try not to.
Fortunately, you have concrete floors.
Yes, that was on purpose and by design, and we actually have a drain in the floor because we wanted. This is like our dream space, so a lot of it was all custom designed for us. So we have a drain in the floor, and we have concrete floors, and that is all by design.
And then once the yarns come out of these vats, these pots, they go on these drying racks over here?
Well, first we take them back to the sink to dump out the water.
Okay.
And to rinse. And you want to rinse until all of the dye is gone. And then we use our spin dryer, which is over here, again, still kind of close to the sink, because you'd be going from the sink to the spin dryer, which is sitting over another area that has a drain in the floor, mm-hmm. so that the water that it pulls out of the yarn can go straight into the drain. Mm-hmm. And after that, then we take it, and we take it over to the drying racks and hang it up to dry.
How long does it stay there?
Overnight, Unless we are really in a hurry.
Can I touch it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I love the yarn.
So, and you see we have fans on the floor. Depending on what kind of yarn is on the drying racks, we turn the fans on overnight to speed it along.
And then what's the next step after that?
After that, we take it off the drying racks in the morning and start the process of actually packaging it, which means that we twist each skein individually into its pretty packaging and wrap a tag around it. And if it's going to a yarn store, we put it in a box and ship out a big box with UPS. If it's going to an individual, we go over to our little shipping area, which we call shipping land. And it's where we keep all of our USPS stuff, all of our small boxes. It's also where we keep all of our labels. So, you know, if we are sending something out, we'll wrap it in tissue paper and package it, print out the label, and then schedule a pickup.
And then all through the center of the store you have fibers themselves.
Yes. All of the center of the store is devoted to the retail side of things. It's full of grid wall, like big metal racks that all have yarn on all sides, as well as a bunch of knitted samples to give people ideas of what they can do.
After this brief break, Collins tells us how she works to build a relationship with communities of Baltimore through her business.
Can you tell us a little bit about the creative process, if that's the right term, for what you do behind developing a particular color?
Sure.
What goes into creating some of these beautiful varieties that I see around me?
Well, so the reason our company is called Neighborhood Fiber Company is because all of the colors are named for neighborhoods. Originally, they were all DC neighborhoods. There are a few Columbus ones thrown in there. It's mostly Baltimore neighborhoods now. So sometimes the process is just about me thinking of, what does this neighborhood remind me of? Or why am I dyeing this? Is it because we need another yellow? Sometimes it's as simple as we need another yellow.
Uh-huh.
This is the yellow we're missing in our color lineup. And then I think about what color, what that reminds me of. So Kristen has just brought me a super bright orange that is named Otterbein for the neighborhood where the Orioles Stadium is. So
nice.
That is
because their color is orange.
Because their color is orange, and opening day was yesterday.
So I noticed that it's not just a solid singular bright orange, though it is very bright. There are also slight differences of shade and texture in the color.
Yes.
Throughout it. Is that something that is deliberate part of the dyeing process? Are there tricks to getting those varieties
Absolutely.
Into the fiber?
Absolutely. We don't want our yarn to look like it was dyed by machine and commercially spun. We want it to look hand-dyed. So part of that is having some variations in the color, even within the colors that are solid single layer colors, which this one is. Mm-hmm. We layer the dyes in the pots most of the time. So some of the colors are single layer colors and they tend to be more solid, and some of them are two layer colors, which tend to be more variegated.
Mm-hmm.
And it really just depends on what color it is.
Some of the yarns that I see around me, not the majority, but a few appear to have even multiple colors in
Yes.
them. They're sort of pebbled with other colors. How do you do that?
So the first thing that we do when we create a layered color is add the dye to the pot.
Mm-hmm.
Then we add the yarn to the pot. And then we add the next layer of color over top of that. So if we work with colors that are very close to one another, it will create something that's much more subtle. But if we work with colors that are really different, like, you know, a dark red layered over a bright turquoise, you end up with something that has elements of both of those and tends to have a lot more variation in color.
Can I ask what the profit margins on this are like?
Our markup has increased as our cost of goods has decreased
because
we're able to buy
scale.
More.
Yeah.
You know, it depends. Like, if we go to a show in California and have $30,000 in sales, that more than covers the cost of you know, flying out there, getting the hotel and the conference, like in the convention center, and also paying the booth fee. Mm-hmm. But the profit margin on a show like that isn't huge because...
It's more about building that clientele over time.
Right, and because, you know, we still had to fly to California. Right. So a show that's in, you know, Catonsville or something that has significantly lower sales has a much better profit margin. Mm-hmm. Our best show is the Maryland Sheep and Wool Festival, mm-hmm. which is coming up in a few weeks. It's the first full weekend in May. But because we don't have any hotel costs associated with it, and because it is a sheep and wool festival instead of a convention in a convention center, it's a lot less expensive to vend.
On days when you're not traveling, which I assume is most of the time, what percentage of your working hours are spent dealing with the public, dealing with people just walking in to the store?
For me personally, a very small percentage, because I would prefer to not be doing the retail side of things. Mm-hmm. I worked 10 years of retail. Mm-hmm. I'm good. Like, I don't need any more retail in my life. So I tend to hide in my little cubby office on the days that we're open, and I'm actually moving my office upstairs.
What's it like living, working, running the shop here in Baltimore now? You've been in DC, you've been in Columbus, different advantages, different disadvantages, I assume, to both. What's Baltimore like?
I love Baltimore. I call Baltimore the land of milk and honey and tell people that they should move here because you can buy a house here. Mm-hmm. And Baltimore is a city with something to prove. So to a certain extent, they're willing to put some money into things like artist housing, mm-hmm. that's affordable, that's actually affordable. Also, Baltimore has neighborhoods. I'm really into neighborhoods. Baltimore has old neighborhoods that have people who have been living in their house for 50 years. And it is changing. There's lots of change happening. There's lots of development. But it just happens slower.
It's also, though, a city with a lot of economic disparities in it. It's like running a shop where you're selling a commodity that's pretty expensive. I mean, it's basically a luxury good.
Yeah, we're selling a luxury good. Our customers are not people who live in this neighborhood, mm-hmm. for the most part.
Do you feel that as a disconnect?
Somewhat. It's challenging because I want to be a part of this community and not just the part of this community that is an expansion of the Mount Vernon neighborhood.
Yeah. Which is
more affluent, and, you know, in Baltimore, affluent means white. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Mount Vernon is more of a white neighborhood. The further west you go, the blacker it gets, and also the poorer it gets, for the most part. Our neighborhood is Seton Hill. So we're sitting here kind of on the line between West Baltimore and Mount Vernon.
As someone who loves neighborhoods and loves Baltimore, do you then try to find ways to interface with the city more generally?
Well, I bought a house in Baltimore. I live on the east side, which is not where my family's from. My grandparents owned a grocery store in West Baltimore on North Avenue. That's where my mother and her siblings grew up. Mm-hmm. So I feel the connection to this city in a way that is completely removed from yarn, mm-hmm. but is still a part of my business.
Yeah.
So some of it is just, you know, I did a project called the Crochet Coral Reef, and I did it in Baltimore in the gallery in the artist apartment building that I was living in. And with that project, I went into a combination elementary and middle school and spent a whole bunch of time teaching kids how to crochet.
Cool.
And making hyperbolic crocheted sea creatures with a bunch of middle schoolers. It was actually a lot of fun.
That sounds rad.
And even though that was like 3 years ago, they're still teaching crochet at that school, uh-huh. in the arts classes. So I think that's awesome. I think that is something that I left for that group of kids. We've done fundraisers for Baltimore causes. We try to be involved. Like, we're part of the city. In some ways, we're still figuring that out because just making money is hard.
Yeah.
You know, I've got employees. It's not just me anymore. So I have to make decisions that are just financial. But I think that it's important to bring people, like my customers who are often from the suburbs, to bring them downtown, to bring them into the city and say, hey, there is a local restaurant that you should definitely walk to. Yeah. And
this why don't you
spend some money in Baltimore? Yeah. That's kind of my goal with getting people to come down here and being open to the public.
Yeah.
I mentioned that we did a fundraiser. After the riots that happened in Baltimore, we were all kind of trying to figure out something to do.
This is the Freddie Gray.
After Freddie Gray, right. No one knew what to do. We all felt like our city was broken and that it was out of our control to fix it. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of the rioting was really about feeling powerless and feeling like there are things that are wrong and I can't do anything about it. So after that, we developed a color and we named it after Sandtown Winchester, which is the neighborhood that Freddie Gray was from. It's where the housing project is that he grew up in. And we donated 100% of the proceeds from that to the Baltimore Community Foundation's Fund to Rebuild Baltimore. It was overwhelming to see the number of people who responded positively to that. And we ended up donating over $10,000.
It's a really beautiful color.
Thank you. It's got purples and blues, and it was a very personal color for me. Since then, we've done other fundraiser colors. We did one after the attacks in Paris for Doctors Without Borders. Mm-hmm. But this was the first one. This one is still my baby. And it's only just recently joined our regular lineup.
Of all the yarns and colors that you have in the store right now, is one your current favorite?
Yes. I am always drawn to the pinks. And right now my favorite is Mondawmin, which is our hot, hot pink. It is also known as our pussy hat pink. Uh-huh. Because it is the color that everyone ordered for their pussy hats when they were making them.
Did you sell a lot during that?
Oh my God.
Women's March season?
There were days where all we did was dye pink yarn. And we were so busy with pink yarn that even I was dying. And I don't dye anymore. I was really mad about it, actually. I was like, I forgot how hard this is. These pots are really heavy. This sucks. Part of the reason I love it is because it was used for the pussy hats. And I liked the idea of sending a color that is named for the place where the real confrontation between the police and the group of high school kids
what was the name again?
Mondawmin. It's named after a mall.
Here in
Baltimore. The mall is also home to a major bus transfer place. So when all of these kids got out of school and the buses suddenly stopped running right after Freddie Gray, they came out of school and were confronted with a whole bunch of riot cops at Mondawmin Mall at the bus stop. Mm. So that's when they started marching through West Baltimore. And I like sending that color to a group of women who are knitting hats for a women's march that is pretty white. Yeah. So I'm like, hey, let me introduce you to Black Lives Matter movement.
So it's an almost accidentally intersectional yarn.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
It was my pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
It was our pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan, and I love a good pair of wool socks, but I learned from Karina Collins that cashmere socks are probably not as good for you as you would think. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the podcast. Our email address is working@slate.com, and we read and try to respond to all of those emails. You can also listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. While we've recorded this whole season already, we welcome thoughts for future seasons and other people you think we should interview down the road in the months ahead. Working is produced and edited by Mickey Capper. Special thanks to the people on Twitter who suggested that we talk with Carita Collins. Special thanks to @losethemittens on Twitter, who suggested that we speak with Carita Collins and learn a little about the Neighborhood Fiber Company. It was a terrific suggestion, and we're really grateful for it. Our executive producer is Steve Lichtai, and the chief content officer of the Panoply Network is Andy Bowers.